to call the February 26, 2009 session of the House Subcommittee on Workforce Development to order. Thank you all for coming out this morning. First order of business is that we're going to have an informational hearing on transitioning from the military to the civilian workforce. We've had a number of folks from the community who've requested a presentation on this, and we're very pleased to have some of our leading military folks from the state here that are going to be speaking to us today. Our first person up this morning is Paul Evans. And Paul, I don't know if you have other folks that you were intending to bring up. If you do, please have them come forward. Okay. We also recognize that some folks may be facing challenging travel conditions this morning, so we'll work around the schedule as best we can. Major Evans, good morning. Welcome to our committee.
Chairman Witt, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to be here. For the record, I am Paul Evans, Policy Advisor for Military Emergency Management and Veterans Issues for Governor Kulongoski. We do have a number of folks that we'd like to bring up as a part of this presentation. I'm going to let them introduce themselves, and then I'll kind of start off the task force in general, and then we'll hand it off in sections.
Thank you very much. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'm Jim Booker. I'm a member of the Governor's Task Force. I also happen to work for the Oregon Employment Department as the Veterans Program Coordinator, and I am an Air Force veteran.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Paula Brown, the Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs.
Welcome to our committee, and thank you for coming out this morning.
And, Mr. Chair, I promised Jim we'd be particularly tough on him today.
Okay.
I did.
So noted.
The bullseye is on you. Chairman Witt, members of the committee, thank you again for this opportunity to come and share about the task force and really how the task force relates to transition services and employment. As we know, the economy now is undergoing a lot of changes, and this is utmost in our mind for the folks that have served and the folks that are coming back. What I'm going to do is we're going to send an electronic copy of a briefing that can kind of walk you through a lot of the issues. I don't want to waste your time here today with that, but we will send you that electronic copy through your administrator. I just want to highlight some of the major points that we discovered during the task force and how it relates to employment. Then I'll hand it off to Jim, and then Jim can hand it off to Paula. And by that time, hopefully, General Caldwell will be here, and we can hand it off to General Caldwell. Executive Order 0808 was signed into existence by Governor Kulongoski last spring, and it was an answer to a question that we had been wrestling with for some time. That question is, what's the best way to help veterans? And I want to just say thank you to all the folks that are in the legislature and have been in the legislature for some time, because a lot of things were done well in 2003, 2005, 2007 for veterans. However, we're getting to the point now where the national government is starting to change focus just a little bit, and we recognize that the opportunities to have a comprehensive approach for veterans policy were kind of slipping by our grasp. So what we tried to do through Executive Order 0808 was put together a large enough task force that was comprehensive in its views and go through every federal, state, and local policy related to veterans that we could get our hands on. That included education, that included employment, that included health care, housing, retirement, aging issues, as well as family issues and women veterans issues. And as we went through a three-month process of looking at all the different policies, it dawned on us that there's a lot of things that sound good, a lot of things that are in place, some of which don't necessarily work as well as we had hoped. But we wanted to go around the communities, around the state, and listen to what people's experiences have been. So we started off with an idea of 6 town halls, which quickly became 24 town halls over the course of the summer. Some of you were a part of those town halls. That provided a lot of helpful information as far as what people thought were in existence and what people were actually taking advantage of. So we tried to put everything back together in August and September. We came up with 39 recommendations. I believe all of you have a copy of the written report now, or at least you should in your office. And of those 39 recommendations, we targeted about 15 for action in the first 2 years and the rest really in the next 2 years. We have a 4-year horizon. Here's some figures that are a little bit helpful to the situation. There are 351,000 veterans in Oregon, according to the census. There are about 80,000 veterans that are currently enrolled in some form of assistance or some form of earned benefit entitlement. That leaves about 270,000 veterans that are out there somewhere. We're not exactly sure where. And we recognize that the biggest obstacle to us is making sure the veterans know what they don't know right now, that there is assistance available and there are benefits they've earned. We also recognize that though Oregon really led the state, or actually led the states, in development of the reintegration program, and sometimes you get tied in lots of different words of what reintegration means. For the purposes of our discussion today, reintegration we defined as the 24 to 36 months after separation from active duty as folks get back into, quote-unquote, their normal life. Most specifically, with Guard and Reserve, but not limited to that. Our reintegration team in Oregon will work with anybody of any uniform service that's trying to get back into, quote-unquote, normal life. But because of the particulars of the Guard, where you're on active duty, you serve, you come back, and you go into active Guard service, but not federal orders, and then you can be called back again, there's a particular focus there. The reintegration team in Oregon really was the model that created a number of programs of outreach. Jim Booker and Paula Brown and others have been a part of that from the very beginning. A unique partnership, really, between the federal government, the state government. But we recognize that it's just not going far enough. And here's what I mean by that. The war has continued. The National Guard, it's not uncommon now for two or three call-ups, which is not uncommon. It's not very far different from what the active duty is experiencing, two or three tours in combat zones. The way we're fighting the war is different. I'm going to take a minute and explain how that's fundamentally different than what we've seen before. But the biggest statistic that I think is helpful to understand the changing dynamic of this war and the veterans and the group of veterans that we're dealing with is that during Vietnam, about 7,500 women served during Vietnam, about 7,500. In this war alone, in Iraq and Afghanistan, the estimates 185,000 to 195,000 probably by spring of this year. That's a fundamentally different makeup than what we've had before, about 22% of the force. So here's a couple of things to kind of put in the back of your brain as we look at trying to get people placed back into quote-unquote normal life and a normal job. First, we know, even as current as this year, that you can look at the workforce of the National Guard in about three sets of thirds. The first third will be deployed. They'll come back. They'll do their thing for king and country. They'll go back to their normal life. They're happy. I mean, a third, pretty much, are going to be okay. Another third will have a job before they leave, but when they come back, after leading people in combat or dealing with the situations you have to deal with overseas, flipping burgers isn't as exciting as it once was. So they're kind of underemployed. They may have a job when they come back, maybe not in today's society, but they thought they would. But they're not really reaching as far as they know they can grasp now. And then there's another third, and that's the third that we're really the most worried about. They're the folks who didn't have a job before they went, probably aren't going to have a job when they get back. And especially among that group, we have grave concerns. So one quick point about how we fight wars and why it's relevant to this subject. In World War II, it was the exception not to have a family member in the service. 16 million men were put into the uniform services during World War II. We fought the war as a nation. And when we fought the war, we had a couple of specifics that really have changed, and I want to emphasize those. First, we had a lot of supply for support, meaning the ratio between the trigger puller and the folks that would help that trigger puller stay on the line, the cooks and the truck drivers and the support were there. We fought wars. We fought that war in a situation where we would plan, we'd execute, and then we'd pull the troops off the line. They'd be refitted, retrained, and they'd fight again. Most specifically, you can look at that in the Pacific campaign, where an island was the objective. They'd take the island, they'd go back to Australia or some other place to refit, retrain, and then they'd go after another objective. Vietnam, the tooth-to-tail ratio was still pretty high, 1 to 10. Some argue 1 to 9, but still pretty high. We had a lot of technical support for the equipment that we were using in the field, but there were really not that many people of the many people that served, not that many people walking the trails and in that hard combat. Now, in Vietnam, there weren't any lines, so indirect fire could happen to anybody. It was certainly a very different kind of place than World War II. But then again, if you look at the force that we sent to Vietnam, those that weren't careerists, those that were draft folks subject to the draft, the deal was you'd serve 11 to 13 months in country, depending on your MOS, and you'd be done, unless you wanted to do a career. In this war, because of a number of changing factors, we didn't have a draft. We didn't increase the size of the active duty by very much. We have depended upon the operational, or I should say, turning the National Guard and Reserve into an operational reserve, where they sometimes are as high as 42% of the force that's in the field. We've sent them multiple times because we had to. And we have gotten to the point where we're even pulling people out of the inactive ready reserve to make sure that we meet our force quotas. That's an involuntary thing, by the way, generally, out of inactive ready reserve. We also fight this war fundamentally different than we ever have before. The ratio now, tooth to tail, is about 1 to 3, 1 to 4. What that means is that the Department of Defense and the previous administration got very creative at using contractors for things that had traditionally been military roles. At first blush, that doesn't seem that important, really. Why not have a cook? Why not have a mechanic that's a contractor? The problem with that is twofold. One, it takes elasticity out of the force. When I was a young officer in South America, if I had an issue where one of my guys had been in the fire a little bit too much, I could send him to the kitchen or I could send him to go work on trucks for a while to kind of get his mind straight. That elasticity is not there anymore because we contracted out. The second thing is, no matter how good or bad the cook was, if I needed another person to have a rifle and be in a hole, I could direct that. In today's world, we have, for example, at Balad Air Base, there were about 8,000 contractors there that we had to protect. Not only were they not able to absorb folks that needed a little bit of in-country time off the line, but I couldn't throw them into a problem. If I had a problem, I had to protect them, which actually limited my flexibility. How is that important? Well, it's important this way. Especially for the National Guard and Reservists, when they come home, they already believe that they've been left out of a year or two. If you believe that whole keeping up with the Joneses thing, they recognize that they weren't around for a while. It's tough to reintegrate to the family. It's tough to try to get back to the job that makes sense. And it's very hard to reconcile the experiences that you've had overseas in today's world where about 2% of the country have any direct connection to the war. A lot of folks used to say that of their World War II generation parents, well, my dad never talked about it. Well, the fact of the matter is he probably did. He just didn't talk about it to you. He talked about it to other vets. Vietnam-era veterans, same thing. They didn't join a lot of the organizations that had been set up after World War II for a lot of political reasons. But Vietnam vets will still talk to Vietnam vets. This war has produced a generation of veterans that really, because of the aging of the VFW and American Legion Halls, because of the inaccessibility of some of the services that are around active duty bases, and again, Oregon doesn't have any active duty bases except the Coast Guard outposts, they don't have even that social support network that previous generations have had. So putting that all into a nutshell, here's what we've got. We've got folks that have been exposed to a lot of interesting times. We have folks that have stresses on their families. We have folks that are uncertain about their jobs, especially those that have mobilized more than one time, because employers can really only be so helpful. And they're coming back into an economy that is uncertain, and we're about to lose a war. And I emphasize that last point because it's all fun and games until the war is over. And then there's a lot of questions about, well, why did I give up a year or 2 years or 3 years? Why did I give up a family? Why did I give up those things? Americans have always been very focused about a job, employment. It's what you do. In America, it's you refer to who you are by what you do. So in our estimation of the task force recommendations, there is nothing more vital than getting a veteran back and employed in something that makes them feel like they are a part of society again. In terms of actual legislation, there is a memorial that we're asking for help at the congressional level to get more DVOPs and leavers in the employment departments. And DVOP and leaver, one of those acronyms that everybody loves, Disabled Veterans Outreach Program and Local Veterans Employment Rep. Ironically, during the last 8 years, at the very time we were ramping up to go to war, we cut the number of DVOP and leavers by 33. Nothing like putting him on the spot.
Yeah, I got it. I just had to figure out where I put it here. Ah, here we go. 18% in DVOT, 45% in LEVER.
So the folks that are supposedly in the employment departments to help deal with veterans at a time we're making more veterans was cut by the federal government. We're asking our congressional delegation to work with us on increasing the number of DVOPs and LEVERs. I also want to emphasize that you're going to see, and for some of you, Representative Escobar, of course, had to see all of these things, but you will all see at some point the memorials coming through the House and the Senate. All of them are linked to specific federal programs or federal initiatives that we're working with the congressional delegation on, Republican and Democratic alike. Congressman Walden right next to our Democratic representatives in Congress and in the Senate. This is a nonpartisan issue. It's doing the right thing, and especially in trying to make sure that in this particular economy, we don't let the skill sets of the folks that have learned a lot waste. So at that point, I'm going to stop. I'll certainly try to answer any questions you have, but I'll hand it off to Jim for the moment.
Let me interrupt just for a minute, Paul, and while you were speaking, I'd like to recognize that General Caldwell has entered the room, and I don't know if you had intended to have him on your panel, but wanted to make sure that you were aware of his presence.
Chair Witt, thank you very much. He actually will be right after Paul when we talk about the reintegration program.
Very good. Thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'd like today to talk about the critical efforts and timing that we've got for veterans right now in terms of workforce issues. I'll be focusing a lot on the Iraq and Afghan veterans because they're the most visible right now. But certainly the issues definitely go across the board to veterans, and we're helping all veterans. But if it sounds like I'm kind of concentrating on them, mostly it's because the Oregon National Guard is our most visible source of veterans in the state, but we do serve all veterans. Again, I will emphasize that this is a critical time for veterans. They face complex family, employment, and health problems associated with multiple deployments, a lack of amenities provided by regular military bases, and an economy that is struggling. The Governor's Task Force on Veteran Services established that getting a job is an important part of transitioning from soldier to citizen. I'm going to describe the employment issues that veterans are facing, and then to also talk about what the Oregon Employment Department in particular is doing in conjunction with other agencies to help veterans. Several factors work together to make reintegration tough for veterans. Some of them are self-imposed, things like the pride issue. You don't want to look like you're weak to other people. Stress issues can help you do things like put things off to the last minute, things like losing your house. We've several times had people come to us and say, I've got to have a job tomorrow, I'm going to lose my house any day now. The pressures are really great. Other obstacles include things like financial issues, transportation costs, housing, work clothes sometimes, things like that. And it can be quite overwhelming when you're combining some of the other things that are happening in your life, like the mental health issues and family problems and things like that. The Governor's Task Force found several things relating to veterans and employment that I think are important to mention here. Veterans' employment needs often intersect with other needs, as I just mentioned. Existing transportation systems and funding for veterans' mobility to and from employment are insufficient to current projected needs. Cuts in disabled veteran outreach program and local veteran employment representatives have significantly affected employment services to veterans, and veterans are reluctant to ask for help and are often not aware of the services that are available to them. The need for the help for veterans is anticipated to increase. If you notice that there have been 7,000 mobilizations since 2001 of the Oregon National Guard, there's a 3,000 member task force heading out and expect to return in 2010. It's the largest deployment of Guardsmen since World War II. The Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs estimates that they're getting 400 to 500 discharge from the regular military, that's not the National Guard, per month. And those folks are also out there looking for work. A survey by the Oregon National Guard reintegration team found that the latest large deployment of Oregon Guard troops, of those, 43% were unemployed upon return. 18% were underemployed, as Paul mentioned just a minute ago. And approximately 40% plan to change careers within the first year coming home. Other statistics confirm that veterans need assistance. In the written testimony that I provided for you, I've got a couple of graphs. One of the initial unemployment insurance claims for veterans in our state, and you can see that there's a continual increase from 2003 to 2008 and a large jump from 2007 to 2008. Also in our Oregon Employment Department IMATCH skills, which is I'll describe a little bit later, we're seeing another jump in veterans registering to look for work there. What are some of the solutions for the problems that we're seeing here? One of them is the local veterans employment representatives and disabled veteran outreach program staff. We're here to help the veterans. And how we do that, one is we're specially trained to help the veterans. We've been given the task to do this. We go through two different training courses at the National Veterans Training Institute in Denver, Colorado. We're also very experienced. Most of the people who work in these positions have either been in WorkSource Oregon for a long time and then have come into the job, or they've had prior experience with things like being a recruiter or a HR specialist, something like that, so they know what they're doing. We help the veterans navigate the system because it's a tough system. There's a lot of things to do. Looking for a job is not a natural thing. It's something that you need to learn and you need help with, and it's nice to have that help, especially someone who understands the transition from being military to civilian. And every single one of our veterans representatives are veterans. That's all we hire. So I'm a veteran. All the other folks I work with are veterans. So if someone comes to us and says, hey, all I need know how to do is carry a gun and shoot people, we know how to turn that into something that can actually be useful in a business sense. We also help provide focused job search, resume writing help. We provide vocational guidance. We're a resource connection. A lot of times when veterans come to us, we're the first government that they get to. And so when they find us and we begin to do an assessment process on them, we often uncover other needs that need to be met. And that's where we work with our partners at Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, the educational community, et cetera, to make sure that those needs are met and any barriers to employment are overcome. We also have some very powerful tools that we supply to veterans. We have the IMATCH Skills Program, which is a program where it's kind of a job application on steroids. It's an online program available 24/7 on the internet. You could access it from Iraq if you so desired. But what you essentially do is you put in your work history and your education history. You can list your job titles, and the system will give you a list of skills that you may have acquired during the time that you've been working. And when you do that, the neat thing about it is as employers put the jobs in that they're looking to fill, we also have the employers put the skills they're looking for, and then the system automatically matches folks. Another great part of the system is that it gives veterans priority or veterans preference automatically. So if you're a veteran and you score as well as somebody else in the number of skills that you have that the employer is looking for, the veteran's name goes to the top of the list. Another great tool we have is qualityinfo.org. It's a labor market information website. As a veteran, if I'm looking for work and I'm kind of curious about something that maybe I haven't done before, this is especially good for the underemployed people switching jobs. I can look up an occupation and find out where the job openings are in the state, what kind of pay I can get per county. So do I get paid more in Multnomah County or Monroe County? You can find out what licensing requirements, where I can get the licensing taken care of, things like that. So it's an excellent website. We also have a transition assistance program class, and I just got done paying to have six more folks trained as facilitators for that in anticipation of the return of the 3,000 troops in 2010. It's a three-day intensive workshop, veteran-focused, to help veterans do everything from start the job search, like how do I even get started? How do I list my skills? How do I find out what I know how to do? What are those transition skills that I need? All the way up to things like negotiating your pay raise. So it covers the whole gamut. Again, I mentioned as a part of the assessment process, we catch other needs like health care needs and mental health or housing and food, and we refer people to the proper place. We've already noted that over the past 5 years, the number of disabled veteran outreach program staff and local veteran employment representatives has gone down. That seems like a counterintuitive thing at a time when the need is going up. So we're hoping that that can be changed. Cooperative efforts with other agencies, such as the Oregon Department of Veterans Veterans Affairs and the National Guard Yellow Ribbon Reintegration Program have helped us meet some of the needs that veterans have. Also, our legislators have helped us quite a bit. The Job Search Transportation Fund was given to us a while back, and we were able to meet some of those job-related transportation costs. Small business repair loans came about because veterans came to us and said, hey, we had a business, and while we were gone, the business suffered, and we need some help getting it back. And ODVA was very instrumental in making sure that that loan was made available for folks. Emergency funds for
Vice Chair Huffman,
yes, sir.
Excuse me.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Jim. On the repair fund, we this week are taking some of that back. What kind of an impact will that have? I was told on Ways and Means Sub that, in fact, I think we were taking a pot back and then that pot increased that we were taking back, if I remember right. What kind of an impact, from your point of view, will that have, taking, and I don't recall the amount we're taking, $150,000 or something from that fund. We were told on the subcommittee that that fund was underutilized. And so there was a pot of money there that we could take back from it.
Sir, I'll have to defer to ODVA for that because they're administering the program.
Okay.
Initially, when Mr. Chair and Representative Huffman,
Would you please identify yourself for the record?
For the record, I'm Paula Brown, the Deputy Director of Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I apologize. When we took a look at the cuts that the department was going to take, we initially took a look at a 5% cut, and the amount that we came up with, because the fund was indeed underutilized at that time, and part of it has to do with timing, because the veteran, when they come back, they have a certain period of time to be able to use that loan. We didn't have folks back at this time who met that criteria and were requesting those funds. So we knew that we had those funds available, and then that we were requesting additional funds for the 09-11 biennium. So what we need to do is ensure that we've got funds available to meet any existing needs, if we have any that come up, but then especially to look forward in the 09-11. And we felt comfortable with that. In fact, we took a second look at that, because what we were looking at cutting also was funds that go to those first-line veteran service officers, the county veteran service officers, and if we could cut a little more from that, to cut a little less from them, to make sure that we're keeping those folks on the front line to meet those veterans' needs. So we felt very comfortable with that. There are still existing funds available. It's about $114,000, I believe, that we have available to meet existing needs, and then we'll move forward. So,
thank you for that. I just wanted to get it on the record in this committee, and that the plan and hope is for the 09-11 biennium to make sure that we have those funds replaced and available. So, thank you.
Thank you, because that's exactly when we're going to have those National Guard and Reservists coming back. We're going to need those funds. Thank you.
Chairwoman, Representative Huffman, I'd just like to second Paula's comments. I'd also like to emphasize that Paula is very polite. And I would put this in a situation that the ODVA made the right decision. They need more VSOs, not less. That's the most important piece, because that's the outreach person to help veterans get into the system. But when you're talking about the cuts, you're talking about cuts. And the fund was created, especially with the small business owner in mind, the one or two person shop. This is the largest deployment of troops from Oregon in 60 years. So an analogy that I would use is, to save a foot, we gave a toe. It's still a toe. I mean, it's still going to, it's not going to help some folks that could use the help. On the other hand, ODVA made the exact right decision. We need VSOs out there, because that is the front line.
Thank you very much.
I will add to that how that came about was, a veteran came to us and he had this small business, and the issue that came up that made it compelling for me is that we have a federal law that helps people who have jobs, veterans who have jobs, who come back to those jobs. But there really isn't a law to protect you if you have a small business in your small business. So that's where that came out of. So just to throw that in there. Some other projects that we've had that have helped veterans out are, we've been able to get a federal grant that was $750,000 per year. We've had it for the past 3 years. It will end June 30th, and the word on the street is that future grants in that area will be much smaller. They won't be that large, probably less than half of what that is. That could change, but for right now, that's what we're seeing. But that grant helped with some of these really important needs, like being able to purchase work clothing. And you'll see, and as of attached, that some of the veteran success stories, many of them hit the point that there are financial issues that need to be taken care of as you look for work. So we went in collaboration with Clackamas County and the Labor's Community Service Agency to obtain that, and it's been a wonderful grant and helped out quite a few veterans. Also, I will mention that the Oregon National Guard Reintegration Team, in conjunction with the Oregon Employment Department, called a summit, an employment summit, together in April 2008. Some of the high points of the recommendations that came out of that is you need to bring the knowledge of programs out to the veterans. They don't tend to come into you, despite the fact that you're there. We're the government, we're here to help. It doesn't really go for very well, and they really would like us to get out there to them. We've gone so far as to go to medical hold companies outside of the state where Oregon Guard people were to make sure that they know what they've got, and we want to make sure that they're getting the message. Also, provide job transportation, clothing, rent assistance, etc. That's a piece that's just always out there, and it can happen for various reasons. Sometimes while you're gone and you're sending your money home, the money's being spent and there's just not a whole lot left over. Sometimes when you get home, you really want to let loose, and one of the ways you do that is you buy a new truck, and then there's nothing left over from the money that you have when you were overseas. Service providers must connect with each other. We've got to leverage our resources. We've got to make sure we know what each other can do. Again, those resource connections is just a really huge strong point. It's been one of the main things that I've learned over the past 4 or 5 years, is that the more I know about what other people do, the better I can help veterans because of the many needs that they have. Find out from state economists what best jobs are out there for the next few years, and make sure you share with troops. Certainly we're doing that on a regular basis. Don't forget the disabled vets. Again, talking about the medical hold people and others. Disabled vets, I've discovered, are just some of the most positive and amazing people I've ever met. I've had stories of guys, double amputees of the arms, wanting to do particular jobs that you might not have thought that they could do, but they wanted to do that. So we pushed and helped them get to where they wanted to go, and sure enough, they were able to do that job. The employer was impressed, and bang, it worked out really well. So our goal is to make sure that any vet that has a dream gets to pursue it as far as they possibly can. This is my vision for what the Employment Department plans to do to help veterans over the next year. We're going to continue to support the Oregon National Guard Reintegration Team. That's just a key piece. There's so many veterans there that need the help, and it's a great way to access veterans, learn about their needs, and make sure that we're there to meet those needs. We're going to expand to the Oregon National Guard Family Program to outreach to them, because we've discovered that typically where we get to intersect with veterans is a demobilization briefing. That's the briefing you get when you come home. So you come home, you can see your family right across the hall there, and you're stuck until all the briefings get done. Do you want to hear Jim Booker talk to you? Heck no. You want to get over to your family. I'm a really nice guy, and people tell me I look like Brad Pitt, but I'm not. But we have discovered that the families are the folks that hear the services that we have to offer and are able to communicate that to the veterans. So we are definitely going to be at all the family support group meetings and continue in that vein. We've already talked about attending demobilization events, participate in the planning and implementation of local veteran summits. We want to bring the message out to local communities. The reason is that the state, per se, doesn't really help a veteran. It comes down to the local level where it really happens. Yes, we provide a lot of wonderful services, but the veteran goes home and he finally kind of decompresses, and then he kind of looks around and says, what help can I get? So energizing communities is one of the things we want to do by bringing people together and talking about what's available in your community, what the needs veterans have are, and then just saying, where are the gaps and what can we do about it? Another thing is we're working with the U.S. Veterans Administration to create a training to help employers retain veteran employees. Sometimes it's tough to have a veteran come back and have them change. the guy that might have been kind of mild-mannered and a nice guy might come back kind of rough and tough, at least for a while, and maybe isn't quite what you thought he should be. But you know what? A lot of times that could be taken care of. Now, we're not the mental health professionals, but we're definitely seeing the need, and so we're working with the VA to make sure that something happens there. Other considerations, we'd like to see that an encouragement to the U.S. Congress to fund more leavers and DVOTs. That's in House Joint Measure 2, and I understand it's moving along nicely. That's great. Resources for veterans, and you know, anybody who's looking for a job right now, they need to be there. This is the time. People are in desperate need, veterans especially. They have a double whammy because they come back and they're a little bit different. They're so concentrated on their military life that it's difficult to make that transition to civilian skills. Develop a state recognition program for employers who hire and retain veterans. It could be as simple as a decal or bumper sticker that only the employers who hire and retain veterans get to have. But we've seen with other states that that's actually an effective way to get veteran or businesses to jump on the bandwagon and do that. Encourage a private sector veterans employment compact. Harvey Platt of Platt Electric mentioned to us that he would be willing to hire veterans who were displaced from other employers for whatever reason. Maybe their business failed or something like that. That's something that I'd like to see happen, and I think it would be a great message to come from the state of Oregon that we think that that's something that employers should do. Basically, in summary, I'd like to say that the Employment Department is one of several agencies that's deeply committed to helping veterans find work. We use trained staff, resource networks, and community involvement to provide veterans with the tools they need to get jobs and to connect to veteran-needed services. That concludes my testimony. I will mention that I've added to your written testimony some employment success stories of veterans and also a contact information sheet listed by county of where veterans representatives are located. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Paula, did you have anything to add?
My comments are very brief. For the record, I'm Paula Brown, Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and as I mentioned earlier, the department has veteran service officers who meet with veterans when they come back, and we help meet a wide variety of their needs. If they need disability compensation because of an injury or an illness that was incurred or aggravated when they were serving in the military, medical care, and employment. One of the things that Jim talked about and has been worked out terrifically for our partnership is we're not local veterans employment representatives at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and they're not veteran service officers. But we have a great partnership so that each of us, when we sit down with a veteran, we talk with them to find out. I can tell you that our veteran service officers always ask about employment. Having served in the military myself, I can tell you, Jim's right, when you come back, number one in your mind, see the family, get a job, because you want to take care of your family. Same thing when my husband got out of the military. See the family, get a job. And so we have an opportunity to talk to them about that, make that connection. And in fact, sometimes, knowing that, sometimes you have one shot with a veteran. You know, we're lucky that we've gotten them to come to see us, so what we want to do is maximize that time with them, and we'll say, hey, we've got somebody over at the employment department that can help you with those employment needs. Let's get them on the phone together right now, get our appointment scheduled, and get that and make that connection happen. There was already a mention of House Joint Memorial 2, which is going to urge Congress to fund those local veteran employment representative and disabled veteran outreach program specialists, those programs. We already know that the Employment Department needs more of those, and so the department is very supportive of that effort. Jim also mentioned the recognition of employers. That's something that the Department of Veterans Affairs is very interested in. I think it gives that visible sign in the community that they are supporting veterans by hiring them, and it gives veterans, maybe it helps them, gives them the encouragement to know that there are businesses in the community that are interested in the skills they have, that their skills do go beyond carrying the gun and shooting at the bad guys when they have to. And then the small business repair program, we already talked a little bit about that. What we did find as we were looking at the needs of veterans coming back is that those who had those small businesses suffered. And in part, the reason they suffered is because they were very small. You know, the veteran was a working partner, a huge part of the work that was being done in that business. And when they were gone, the business truly did suffer. The other part that the department at some time in the future is interested in is the veterans who come back and they're interested in starting a business. There are a number of reasons why folks do that. Perhaps they're not fitting into the typical job that they're going to come back to. Maybe it's just that entrepreneurial spirit that's in them. And at some time, you know, we would be interested in being able to provide funds for that as well, maybe to help with their business licenses. You know, it wouldn't have to be a lot of money because there are other programs available, but just something that could give them that little boost that's going to help them on their way. And then one last thing I want to mention is vocational rehabilitation. As we're looking at, as we're meeting with our veterans and we're helping them with all of their needs, one of the things we take a look at is sometimes they come back and they're not able any longer to do what they did before. Perhaps they have an injury such as a back injury, whatever the injury might be that prevents them from doing what they previously did. Vocational rehabilitation is a program that will help them get the retraining they need to seek another profession. And so as we work with the veteran to do that, we do that in partnership with the unemployment department, the employment department, so that we make sure that we're trying to make a good career match for that veteran as well. So I guess in summary, the partnerships that are happening in Oregon, we're very proud of, and I think we can all be proud of, because we've all recognized the value of the services each of us provide. And certainly thank this committee for your time this morning to allow us to talk a little bit about that. I can be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. And we obviously thank the three of you for your time as well. Open it up for questions and comments. First, please, Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I'll try to move along quickly. I have about three questions. If I wrote the number down right, I believe somebody said that there were the unemployment rate was about 43% of veterans returning. Is that correct?
Sir, that was one particular group that came back, but we have noticed that it's approximately that high with the past two groups that have come back. We never thought to check it before, you know, and then in demobilization exercises, we began to ask, how many of you are out of a job and how many are going to be looking? And that's what we discovered through that.
Now, I can understand that maybe some of them were unemployed when they were deployed. While they were deployed, maybe a business that they had worked at went out of business. But I thought we had, you know, guaranteed placement of these guys and their jobs that they left to be deployed. But that apparently is not correct.
Chair Witt, Representative Huffman, General Caldwell is actually going to be up here in a minute or two to kind of go into some of the details about kind of the bigger picture of related to National Guard employment pieces. But there is something in law, United Servicemen's
Uniformed
Services
Employment and Reemployment Rights Act.
Benadryl does not help with acronyms. Bottom line is, there is a requirement for employers to give a person the same job or equal to when they come back. The problem is threefold. One, when that was put into place, when it was codified, it was still under the old idea that the National Guard and Reserve would be used only in the time of a really big war, and once they come back, they're back. This idea of going back and forth like a yo-yo was never really part of the plan. Second piece is that the federal government, ironically, the federal government and, in some cases, the state government are not great examples of even following that law. And private employers have seen that example, and some private employers have gotten around it. Now, some employers do it because they have to make ends meet, and they can't afford to keep a job open when they've got to have someone doing things. And that's life. The other piece is that there are some employers that purposefully now are actually manipulating things so they don't have to give the job back. And we're working on a number of different tools to try to help reinforce the fact that that is, in fact, a law. We have had a conference. Mr. Booker talked about the compact between employers, which is a voluntary thing, which we are working on. We're also working on an education campaign through business organizations to make sure human resources divisions of the companies understand this isn't a nice thing to do. It's not a really good policy. It is, in fact, the law. So we're trying to help buttress that up. But the problem, again, is that, especially in an economy like this, it isn't too hard to say, well, there were layoffs and we just had to lay somebody else off and they just happened to be the guy or gal. And the other factor is that, people being people, when Johnny goes off to fight for his country, they hire somebody and they start to like that somebody and they get used to that somebody. And then it's seen as kind of a an obstacle in a way to kind of have to put that person back in their job. And we're trying to work and with employers, sweeten the water on one hand and make the stick a little bit stronger, because ultimately we can't keep a stable National Guard in reserve if people aren't going to have a chance to get their job back when they come home. And again, from my own unit, we were mobilized for 2 years involuntarily. The United States Post Office was actually the worst offender in that case. Two of our people came back to not just a different route and a different job, but the worst route that you could have, and they lost seniority, which was against the law. So it does happen.
Okay, thank you. Number two, we used to have GI Bill, and then we had kind of a money match thing in the 70s and whatnot. What do we have now for college and training for vets when they come back? Is there any type of a program like that?
Well, veterans do still have, Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, veterans do have veterans benefits when they come back. There are a number of different programs that, you know, that used to be called the GI Bill. There's going to be a new GI Bill that's for those who served after 9/11, which is a much more robust program than what we've had over the last few decades. We do also have a state educational aid program that's in place that provides $150 a month for full-time attendance, $100 a month for part-time attendance for the number up to the number of months the veteran served, or 36 months. And one of the issues with that program is that you're unable to use it at the same time you're using your federal benefit. We're interested in allowing those veterans to use that program at exactly the same time they're using their federal benefit. That's when they're going to school. So there are some educational benefits. And then I also mentioned the vocational rehabilitation for veterans who might need some retraining. Certainly the GI Bill is probably their best program available at this time, the number one choice.
Chair Wood, Representative Huffman, again, General Caldwell can explain more about this, but the new GI Bill is the best bill to come down the pike for active duty members. For the Guard and Reserve, it's not necessarily as good as advertised, and the reason for that is it's all based on number of months on active duty. And I believe it's a 60, 80, 100% split, but if you're on active duty for 12 months, you get 60% of the gig. If you're on active duty for 24 months, I believe it's 80%. Is that right? 60, 80? Or is it 75? 60, 80, 100. That's right. All right. Surprise me. 36 months is 100. Now, the good and the bad of this is that we actually do have some guys and gals in the National Guard that can equate to the 36 months of active duty.
That's cumulative?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir. But the problem, of course, is if they're away for 36 months, there's probably some other issues involved as well. So, General Caldwell, I think, will testify in a little bit that the Montgomery GI Bill, which is still out there as well, in some cases is better for certain National Guardsmen. We are working on some other bills, and that's kind of what I wanted to segue into, if possible, that we see as facilitators to make that easier and better for the National Guard specifically. We're pushing for 5 or more campus veteran service officers that are folks on the campus to make sure that if people come in and they're veterans, we not only get them whatever GI Bill or Montgomery Bill they may be entitled to, but we get them plugged in the system so the other things they're entitled to they get as well, which can help their families. We also are pushing for, and this is something that really, we need your help, House Joint Memorial 4. And I know that legislators are loath to get too involved in memorials because it's kind of a note to Congress saying we want this, but the most important thing, the most vital tool that can help our Guard and Reserve and their families be sustainable is what we call the 90-day soft landing program. It is a 3-month approach. Instead of what we have now, again, we have, thanks to the guys sitting behind us and the people up here, we have, I think, the best reintegration program in the country. General Caldwell, Mr. Booker, Paula, Jim, everybody has made that happen. But the core of it, because of limitations of fiscal restraints, are that it's kind of an outside in. We give them the best information possible. We have a crew of people that try to help them. But we don't have that last piece. And that last piece is economic stability for a 3-month gradual reentry into their normal life, where they don't have to be worried about paying the mortgage note the first month, where they don't have to be worried about the transition of health care back and forth on their families. They can actually get back. We can take our time. We can teach them what they need to be taught. We can assess where they, what skills they have to get them in the right job. We can get them the mental and the physical health tests and support that they might need, and do it in a way that makes sure that when they go back to the normal life, they're prepared for it. And HGM-4 is the tool for that. Nationally, veterans organizations are recognized as this is important, and so far it's always been a matter of money. And I challenge the committee, if you can get behind this, it isn't a matter of money if you think about it, because if we get people put back into their life the right way, we're not paying for long-term costs 20, 30, 40 years down the road. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's vital. And the new GI Bill, as well as the Montgomery Bill and the other educational pieces, are critical. One other aspect that your committee has, I think, direct connection to, and I don't know that it requires a bill, but we have to solve the problem where military credit doesn't equate to credit at community colleges and universities. It is... Yes, sir.
Can I interrupt you there? Because that was my next and final question, or what are we doing? And I just talked to Commissioner Preuss this week. It's something that I think Representative Escobar has mentioned on this committee. One of our goals through workforce and education is to diploma more people in Oregon.
Right.
Skill up. Get diplomas in their hands. And I would think some of the low-hanging fruit would be veterans that are coming back with, you know, 4 or 6 months of AIT under their belt. Is it called AIT anymore?
Yes, sir.
Advanced
Yes.
Individual Training. You know, some of those are college-level courses that you would think could be certificated. And I know that we do have a program in place. My question to Kim was, are we bringing these people in and addressing that with them, maybe through IMATCH or at the employment department when you're discussing employment and educational options with them, looking at what their certificated programs are and saying, let's turn this into college credit. And, oh, look, you've got enough that maybe 2 more terms and you could have your associates or whatever.
For the employment department, that's a little bit beyond what we are able to do. However, we are working with the local community colleges to get that recognized, and the community colleges are stepping up and looking at this. So I think it is happening. Could it happen faster? Boy, I'm sure I'd love it to. I'm not sure what it would take to do that. But definitely they are looking at it.
Well, Kim was really taking notes when we were last visiting about it, and so I'm kind of pushing, because I think that's a key to a couple of different things we're working on.
I
agree.
Do you want to go on? Again?
Go ahead. I was just going to say the campus VSOs are going to help
with
that.
Chair Witt, Representative Huffman, the campus veteran service officers, really one of the pieces is to help be a partner on the campus with the federal education person that campuses already have to make sure that some of these pieces fall into place and it's easier. And I saw him walk in the room, Mr. Sager. I want to emphasize that Mr. Sager and the community colleges have been very willing to sit and talk and try to figure out a good strategy for this. There's no bad actors in this at all. In fact, everybody's trying to move forward. The challenge, there's really 2 structural challenges. One is on the military side of the house, of course. One is on the state side of the house. It was explained to me in very clear detail from one of the folks at Chemeketa Community College that writing 101 at one community college may not be the same as at another community college. And somehow, and I don't know how that works, but somehow we've got to figure out that if those classes aren't the same, at least the military stuff is the same, because that's one provider, right? The other piece on the military side of the house is you've got widely disparate approaches to training and education. While I love the Air Force, and I'm also the guy that picks on the Air Force probably more than anybody else in the room, one thing they do right,
but they eat very good.
We eat very well, and we got big bombs. I mean, that's but the community college of the Air Force, that's one thing they did right. All the training and curriculum is actually equated to a specific class in the community college of the Air Force, which is accredited. The Army and the Navy are trying to get to there. They're not there yet. So on the one hand, military needs to do some things that makes it easier. On the other hand, in the interim, especially for things like driving vehicles and EMTs and firefighting and some of the skills that there is a formal class in the military that they actually have civilian instructors at as well, it makes a lot of sense to kind of take those steps. And again, I don't know that it needs a bill as much as just support from the committee to emphasize that this is a priority and a continuing priority, because I know the community colleges have their hands full right now with everything else they're doing. But if we can get someone from the military back into work quicker, everybody wins.
Just to follow up, Paul, one of the approaches that I had for CAM was a motivation for community colleges possibly as a revenue source. You know, if you don't have to have a butt in the seat, but you can collect X dollars per credit hour and just certificate that, you know, it could be a revenue source for community colleges, and that might pique some interest.
Yes, sir.
Very good.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Huffman, do I remember sit on the Education Committee?
Yes.
It might be, we might ask you to carry back the message to the Education Committee that we heard this testimony today and that this could benefit a number of our state's veterans.
Thank you, Chair Witt, and I will. I mean, this is something that I think, like I mentioned just a little bit earlier, I think it's some... a real benefit to veterans, a benefit to the state and our workforce, and it's potentially some low-hanging fruit.
Yes, sir. Sir, please. Chair Witt, if it pleases the committee, I'm going to get up and let General Caldwell come up and finish our piece of the presentation about the National
Library
Integration.
Very good. Before the current panel leaves, I know that Representative Dembrow had a question. So
I think Representative Esquivel had one first.
Okay.
He's Representative quicker Esquivel. On the draw than
I think. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
The most important piece here, in my opinion, is the soft landing. Now, having said that, I'm going to give you a scenario. For a year or more, you're in a very violent environment. You leave that environment, and in my case, 3 days later, I was out on a street corner. That isn't enough time to adjust what's happening to you. You want to get home to your family, but then you find out your family's changed, but more importantly, that you've changed. At that time, a veteran probably is not going to make a career decision. They need time to, one, get their act together and adjust back to what of a peaceful environment as well as a family environment. And more importantly, they need to decide later on what career path they want to go down. And I can't emphasize that any more than it's probably, to me, the most high priority that we have in this nation is to allow those veterans that are coming home, those soldiers, to have that time to unwind and to adjust, because it's such a cultural shock when you leave that environment and come home, just like it is when you leave home and go into that environment.
Thank you very much, Representative Esquivel. I remember a good number of my friends who, when they came home from Vietnam, it was a very challenging time for most of them, and they needed that time. It was critically important, and had a family member of mine who, absent I think that three-month decompression time, would have been in some real difficulties. So you bring up a very important point. Representative Dembrow has a question. I think you also sit on the you're vice chair of the Education Committee.
I am.
And if you could, maybe along with Vice Chair Huffman, carry the message back to the Education Committee that we've heard some things here that would assist our veterans in terms of education requirements, that would be much appreciated.
Right. I'd be happy to do that. I'd be happy to speak to the administrator of that committee as well.
Thank you very much.
He's sitting next to you.
My goodness, we have a lot of cross-pollination here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Huffman opened up the line of questioning I'm really interested in, and that is the training and the coordination between the experience that service persons have acquired in the military as they come back, how we can make those credits transfer. I would also like to see, if possible, work experience translate into apprenticeship programs as well. I mean, so that we're not just looking at college credit. College credit is it is an issue, and you know, I'm from that world myself, and I know that you know, there is going to be some resistance on the campuses to just broad notions of credit for prior learning. You know, those have been abused at times in the past, and so the more closely we can actually tie this to specific training programs in the military, I think the better off we are. You know, having said that, I have become increasingly convinced that we really, in the colleges, need to be working aggressively in this area. And I think that it is being talked about at the colleges, but I think that we as legislators need to figure out a way to just put a little more teeth into that conversation, just to make sure it happens. In the community colleges, things happen very, very fast compared to higher ed. But compared to, I think, our needs at the moment, they still work pretty slowly. And so I think we need to figure out a way to just light the fire a bit. And I'll say that publicly, although it'll probably come back to haunt me from some of my colleagues. But I think it really is important here. You know, one of the differences that I see in the classroom is between those vets who are coming from the regular military, where they probably did have, you know, a lot of, they were involved in training programs, they were developing specialties, et cetera, and vets coming from the Guard, where they didn't have that same level of training while they were in the military that could then transfer into new careers. And I don't know if the general is going to address this, but
yes. Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative General, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. Every active duty soldier and every in Guard and Reservist go to the exact same school. There's no differentiation between one and the other. They can be on the same level, same program of instruction. They get the same certification from the military. So there isn't a difference in training. Now, there could be a difference in experience. Obviously, one person is going to do that, I guess, technically 365 days a year, although we know that isn't the case. With leaves and other trainings that they have, it's not, they're not going to do that job every single day of their 365. We obviously work 2 days a month, 2 weeks in the summer, so you will have a difference in that level, but not certification. They got to pass the same test, every single one of them. It doesn't matter whether you're a general or a private. You go to the same schools and pass the same test. It's just more difficult when you're a citizen soldier because quite often you got to do it in increments. You got to do it a longer period of time, but you have the same exact instruction with the same quality and or competencies have to be required. You talked about the college credits, and it's gotten a good deal of discussion. There is a standard national program that accredits every military course with a like and kind. It's really up to the individual institution whether or not they accept that and whether or not they use that same standard, and I think that therein lies the difficulty. We've found, as Paul mentioned, that even in the community colleges and the universities in this state, that English 101 at Eastern Oregon University is not the same English 101 at Oregon State, and same with the community colleges. So I think that's more of an internal issue. I think it's also an issue that we, if we're going to have a policy as a state of Oregon, I think we need to say we're going to have a policy that you all get on the same sheet of music. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe that's a different sheet of music. Paul's example of the Air Force community college is a great one. I mean, that's accredited. It's run by educators. And that might be the place where we all start and get the team together to discuss that. But that's the thing that we've learned in discussing it with community colleges particularly and a couple of universities is they all kind of look at it differently and they all kind of accredit it differently. And I think therein lies the problem. The other thing I think Jim was going to jump in on is the issue about apprenticeships. That's just, we're just starting to make some headway there. And that's just in the last year that we've been able to get with several of the trades unions and say, you know, we got engineers, quote-unquote engineers. Are they qualified, ready to go out and pour concrete, build buildings? Not when they come out of their basic advanced individual training, as Representative Huffman mentioned, but they're certainly capable of being an apprentice, a laborer, that sort of thing. So how do we equate that learning, that instruction that they got into credits in the apprenticeship program? It's just beginning. I think we got a lot of work to do there. But the good news is that they're leaning forward. The unions are wanting to help us in that area. So I think that's fertile ground to be plowed as we move down the road. Does that answer your question?
Yes, that's great. I'm pleased to hear that.
And that's probably a very great segue into Representative Holvey's questioning, and he is, I think, one of our committee's biggest advocates for apprenticeship. Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Geez, I've been sitting here quietly trying to figure out how to jump into this, and you presented so much material, I just don't really know how to start. I almost feel like I should declare a conflict of interest. I have two family members that are currently in the Army. One will be out in less than a year, and the other one, I don't know, maybe 15 years, who knows, or maybe 5 years. But I just wanted to touch on something you said earlier about the program of having that outreach to the families, because I think that is absolutely critical as I watch my family members and notice, you know, some changes in them, and it takes them a long time to figure out that they've changed and that their attitudes have changed somewhat, and that sometimes becomes a barrier. And I think families are very well positioned to, you know, prepare, you know, for their family members to come out of the service and to help them negotiate getting back into civilian life or going to school or whatever it may be. I know my family members, they're working through or participating, I guess, online through Pacific University in Washington, where they can hook up with their training while they're in the service and take online classes through that university and get credit for that to help, you know, one of them's a nurse and, you know, and so that's really helpful. I don't know that Oregon has any community colleges that are actually working directly with the military to facilitate that. So that would be something I think would be very helpful. And now that you mentioned apprenticeship, you know, I will offer myself to help you reinvigorate Helmets to Hard Hats in the state of Oregon. I will get pass this out to the committee here. I've got a big article on Helmets to Hard Hats. It's being championed in the Northwest right now and across the country. And if the committee would indulge me, I'll just take a minute.
Please do, Representative Holvey.
I just want to read this, just so for the record the committee members know, that Helmets to Hard Hats is a national program that connects National Guard, Reserve, and transitioning active duty military members with quality career training and employment opportunities within the construction industry. Headquartered in Washington, D.C., the nonprofit program is administered by the Center for Military Recruitment Assessment and Veterans Employment Direction. For management of the center comes from a board of trustees comprised of equal numbers of employer and labor trustees. Launched in January 2003 with funding from the Defense Department, Helmets to Hard Hats provides an important link to veterans or soon-to-be veterans and construction trade unions clamoring for their skills. And I might you know, just interject right now. I mean, this committee knows I've done a bit of work on just looking at the needs in the construction industry and manufacturing as well in apprenticeship programs. And we need a heck of a lot of people in that industry in the next 16 years, next 10 years, actually. And, you know, I just think this program, there's got to be some way we can really reinvigorate this in the state of Oregon. The state of Washington passed a resolution a couple of years ago trying to do that, and it's aimed at getting direct entry to apprenticeship programs for veterans. And the implementation of a statewide direct entry program gives former and active military personnel the opportunity to quickly start quality construction careers soon after they apply for them through Helmets to Hard Hats. Once a state proclamation is signed, it allows JATCs and locals to immediately accept these men and women into their apprenticeship programs and provide them with credit for their military training and experience. And that's the framework, I think, that we need to look into. And maybe you know more about it than I do, about where Oregon is right now with trying to get that going. But I'm going to offer up my assistance and go to the State Apprenticeship Council if necessary and see if we can just get this thing kicked into gear, because not only do we have veterans coming back to the state of Oregon, and I might add that they're not all National Guard and Reserves, but largely there's a lot of them, but we do have regular military coming back to Oregon too. But it's a perfect time for us to really be jump-starting that in Oregon, because as we see this economy flattening out and the stimulus money going into infrastructure and the need we have in the industry, at the same time we have veterans coming back. I think there's a huge opportunity here. And I'll make a copy of this, or give it to the administrator, make a copy of this article for the committee, Mr. Chair, if you so wish. I'm really excited about doing something around this specifically. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Polvy. And if you feel that a letter from this committee would in any way be helpful to your pursuit of those ends, we would be pleased to be able to do that. If there's anything else that you think this committee could do to help emphasize your efforts or to support them, please let us know. But good job.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just add, I would imagine the Apprenticeship Council is just, you know, they're ready to do this. We just need to figure out what the logistics needs to be between the Department of Veterans Administration and the apprenticeship programs directly, and you know, get them hooked up and try to keep government from, you know, having too many roadblocks in the way of making that happen. And I don't know if it's a funding issue. I don't think it's a funding issue, really. I think we can do this without much funding, but at this, or at least get the framework set up. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
And Mr. Chair, if I might just comment on, and we do appreciate that, and I think that we have, as I said, started down this path in the last 18 months, and I think we've made good progress, but we're only dealing with a small segment of the trades union. Unions and trades councils, and so we need to expand that. And I think your offer, we will certainly take you up on that. Many of what you've heard today, and I don't want to reiterate that. Sorry, I was late, but we were stuck in traffic getting into town. So,
I'd like to officially welcome you too, General Caldwell.
Thank you very much. Part of everything's been said here that I think needs to be said, but let me just try to kind of put a little icing on the cake with respect to the panel you've had, which have done a superb job in not only assisting the guardsmen who have been deployed over the last 7 years, but also the reservists and other active duty personnel. Paul mentioned the 90-day soft landing. I think it's just absolutely critical, and I can say that in a lot of respects, and I'll give you an example. When we deployed the 2nd Battalion, 162nd Infantry, which was primarily out of we were headquartered in Eugene, but it was primarily a Willamette Valley organization. We had people from all over the state. In fact, as we had people from out of the state also volunteer to go with them. They were in Iraq in 2003 and 2004. We had 11 casualties in that group, and it did create some serious issues that we frankly weren't ready, we were not prepared to deal with. That's when we started the reintegration team, recognizing we had wounded coming home. We were seeing problems with the wounded that were finally getting released from the hospitals and sent after we argued and fought and raised all kinds of noise to get those soldiers to be rehabilitated in the communities. The Army finally did that. They were slow in coming, but they got it done. Then we started seeing issues that we just frankly weren't ready to prepare. We were not prepared to deal with. That's what was the genesis of the reintegration team. We didn't know what we didn't know. We knew how to get people out the door. We knew how to train them, get them out the door, get them to war. We didn't know how to get them back. We had one unit that had come back earlier than that, and we did absolutely nothing other than say, we'll see you in 90 days. Have a nice life, and we'll get back to you. You know, if you got a problem, let us know.
Well,
we just simply were so busy and so focused on pushing people out the front door, we weren't even thinking about the back door. I think it's made us a lot of money. As Paul indicated, we were copied by most of the other states when the national level, the Guard Bureau finally decided that, you know, gee, this is an issue. We ought to think about this. Let's pull everybody together and see what they're doing. Our folks went back, and again, we were doing it on a shoestring. I went to the governor and said, we need some money because we don't have federal money to do this with, but we need to do this. He was very accommodating. He said, I'll do whatever you need. We put together a team kind of by catch as catch can. We were actually building the bicycle while we rode it, which creates all kinds of issues. And we were learning as we went. And it was a great team effort from all the different state agencies, federal agencies, the VA, you name it. Everybody wanted to help. So it was first trying to sort out what they did, how they did it, and how do we put that together to make it a viable organization that can actually help people. As we found out at that first meeting that the Bureau had, we'd been in business about 9 months at that point. And they said, at the end of the meeting, they said, every one of you get with Oregon and copy their program. That's what we want to do nationwide, which is pretty much what's happened. So we're very proud of this organization. We think we've done a lot of good things. What we didn't know, as I said, we didn't know what we didn't know. We brought back the 2162. We knew we had some issues that were, you know, related to the traumas that they'd gone through with their fellow soldiers being killed in action. We thought, well, we knew when they left that the economy was similar to what it is today, probably not as bad. But over half of them were unemployed when they did. They didn't have a job. So we said, let's have a big job fair. Let's get these people employed. And employers showed up in droves. I mean, it was marvelous. They held it down here on State Street. We had a collective audience, had a whole battalion, 600 people. And we said, by God, half of them are unemployed. We're going to get you jobs. And we had people, employers lined up from hell to breakfast wanting to hire these guys. And they had all kinds of different opportunities. And every one of them said, I'll hire a guy on the spot.
Wow.
Out of the 300 and some people that went through there that did not have jobs to go back to, you know how many jobs we got that we were taking that night? None. Zero. Not a one. And we were stunned. We were absolutely stunned. And it was back to what Representative Escoval said earlier. We didn't know what we didn't know. They just simply weren't able to come out of a combat zone 7 days later, 8 days later, and say, we're going to hire you and go to work. They couldn't deal with that. So we had all of this disappointment, not only for us that put it together, thinking we've done all these wonderful things. Why aren't these people, you know, grateful? You know, why aren't they taking jobs? And we didn't understand the mentality that they had to adjust to that time frame. So that was absolutely critical that we understood that. We've learned from those mistakes. We've had those job fairs since then. I can tell you, the employers that I talk to whenever we have a job fair, and I'm sure Jim can echo this in spades, they say, we don't care if they have the job skills. We don't care if they know anything about what I do as an employer. I can train them that because I know these people are going to show up on time. They're going to be in the proper uniform. They're going to have the proper attire. They're going to be drug-free, and they're not going to 3 days later take a mental health day.
Yeah.
They're going to show up and work, and I can train them whatever my needs are. I will train them, which I think is another example of what, you know, the veteran offers to the employer. We talked a lot about, you know, what do we need to do? Well, again, that 90-day period is critical. During that 90-day period, if we had that 90-day period, what we would look at is a career readiness certification for not only the job skills that we know that they have based on their documented military training, but also the other soft skills that perhaps they brought to the table before they even came to us. I would think that would be an absolute must, and we would love to have the time to assess them and give them the test, but it's basically we give an ASVAB when they come in, Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery, that tells us, the military, what is this person good at. We can also take that same test and then either one, redo a similar one that's on the market today to say, you know, you ought to be looking at mechanics because you tested high in that area. You ought to be looking at science because you've got a great science background. Those are the things we do not have time to do now. And that would help us get to the career readiness certification. So now we can have a guardsman, a reservist, an active duty person, a veteran, period, come back and say, this is what we know, Mr. Employer. We are certifying this based on the fact that we know what this person's done, both in recorded and what is tested, what their potentials are. We just simply don't have the ability to do that right now, and I don't know how we're going to get to that, but I think that's part of this whole process as we look at our situation. To give you a couple of examples of what we're facing right now. As you know, 3,000 guardsmen are going to deploy in May to be deployed to Iraq for 1 year. They'll be back next July time frame, roughly, June, July, somewhere in that neighborhood, if things go according to plan. Out of that 3,000, we've done what we call a soldier readiness profiling, and we go through all of the tables you can imagine if you've been in the service. I mean, it's the get in line, wait your turn, get to the next station, get a stamp, go to the next station. It's a little bit drudgery, but nevertheless, it's important because we try to get everybody through each station. One of those stations is the employment station. Out of that 3,000 right now, we have 968 of those soldiers are unemployed. And that's not counting unemployed. That's unemployed. About 160 of them we have on temporary duty getting ready for the deployment. And we kind of had to figure that out. So what is your main level of employment? Some of them put, you know, temporary guard duty. And some of them only have their two-day-a-month check. So that's about the average that Jim talked about 40%. We didn't go through how many of them were underemployed, but we know there's a certain number by statistical averaging. 167 of them are students, 27 are self-employed out of that group. And we have about 100 of them that are employed outside the state of Oregon in one form or another of the rest of the group that's employed. So we know going in that we're going to have roughly 40 to 50% of these soldiers when they come home, 1,500 of them roughly, that we're going to have to figure out what they're going to do. They're going to go back to school, they're going to go get more training, or whether they got to get a job. And that period right post-deployment, the money's gone. Some of them are getting more money now than they've really ever seen because they get a full-time check, plus they get the benefits. If they're married, they get another benefit check that goes to their spouse. So those monies quit within 2 weeks of their return home. And that's where the crisis usually comes. That's what we've learned through reintegration. That's when we see the alcohol abuse. That's when we see the family problems that they haven't reintegrated properly. Now, the other thing we've learned through this process is that if we don't do a very, very effective job working with the families while they're gone, before they leave and while they're gone, then we have problems afterwards. And we've robusted that. The federal government has stepped up and provided more resourcing for that. So now we have something on the order of like 8 or 9 family program people. 2003 to 2004, we had one. We had one paid family person for the state of Oregon for 8,400 people, which makes it a little bit difficult to make any real progress in that respect. We have great volunteers, but now we're up to 8 or 9 where we're able to reach out and pull these family programs together and educate the families, get them into, there's money to buy speakers and professionals, and the VA's been good about coming in. Jim's been to several of the family programs to talk about employment. And the other thing that we've been able to do, thanks in large part to the community colleges, and I want to particularly point out, Clackamas Community College has really, really stepped up. They've gone way above and beyond what I think any of us expected, where they are offering opportunities for family members to get education. And that particular program is kind of a subset of what they're doing. They've got a foundation set up. Miles Fiberglass has seeded that foundation with $150,000 to $200,000, something like that. And they've been raising money for that foundation in order to pay for the spouses of these deployed soldiers. And this is active guard and reserve. So that is a real step forward to try to do that education piece for the families.
Sir. Your husband.
General, in regard to that, and I could be mistaken on this, but in my own family, an area that I see that we might be lacking, if I understand it right, and I hope I'm wrong, one of my daughters, her husband was deployed, Oregon National Guard. The same trauma that we've been talking about. He got home within a year. They were divorced. And once they're divorced, to the best of my knowledge, she doesn't qualify for any of those benefits now. I'd like to somehow see that corrected because, you know, because of the trauma that happens, it was neither one of them's fault. Carl continues to get the benefits coming to he, the veteran. Sarah gets nothing because they're divorced. Probably heard that story before. I just thought I'd...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huffman, we've heard that many, many times. The Clackamas Community College example is private money. It's their operation. There's no government support in that. And I think if there is an area that probably needs, I'd say another resolution, but it's really, in my opinion, that the federal government ought to be stepping up and providing some resourcing for that very, very thing. Not only after a situation like you've just talked about, but during the deployments and during the time that the soldier's on active duty, for whatever reason, if he's a volunteer for a 3-year hitch, 6-year hitch, whatever the case may be, and or part of reserve. I think that ought to be part of the equation, because it will make a big, big difference in the outcome of that family at the end of the deployment.
Yes.
I
think Paul has a comment.
Chair Witt, Representative Huffman, sorry for jumping up and down on this one, but this is one near and dear to my heart. What the General said is absolutely true, and what your family has experienced is unfortunately the unanticipated consequence of the National Guard and Reserve on this current structure. And what I want to emphasize is, on active duty bases, there are programs while a person is deployed to take care of them. In the Guard and Reserve, Oregon is, again, head and shoulders above the rest in trying to reach out. But because our guys and gals are spread all across the state, it's very difficult, especially with veterans and veterans' families. In my own experience, my first wife would not ask for help, would not ask for anything. And it was seen by her as a respectful thing of me not to be asking of help. And I didn't know what was going on, so I couldn't ask for help for her.
And oftentimes, family is pushing Sarah. Look, there's this stuff out there. No, I don't want to.
Right. And one of the things that I'm most excited about right now, in terms of what we can do and what we should be asking for, what we should be asking for is absolutely what you're talking about, and it's really the whole family concept. The Veterans Administration and the military need to recognize that the whole family concept now, with the way we fight wars, is the better model than just the soldier, sailor, airman, or marine themselves, because we fight wars differently than we used to. Internally, or at least in the short term, I'm really excited that the faith community has been tagged to inclusion. I believe they've met once, and they're going to be meeting again on March 11th or something like that. And because this deployment is so big, the reintegration team has been asking throughout the state for the faith community to become engaged in this, and I think they're surprised by how many people are coming forward. It's an opportunity for all the folks that want to help and to recognize that the family, especially young families, don't know how to ask for help. I'd also like to emphasize that there is a bill that is being sponsored by Representative Clem and a whole lot of folks declaring May 8th Military Family Appreciation Day. And I want to emphasize what that is to do. It's not simply to hold up the family and say, wow, they're great. Rather, what it's to do is to hopefully throughout the communities, especially in the areas where there are folks being mobilized, to bring city, county, and local leaders together to talk about what being a military family means, so everybody has a better understanding of how this fits into the Guard, Reserve, and returning active duty families. To do some of the education pieces that explain how, when there are children in schools, how their life is affected by having someone that's in the military, how the communities can actually recognize that when Johnny goes deployed, somebody has to fill Johnny's job, and there's an impact on that family as well. And the overall emphasis is to recognize that Oregon, we're all in this together. Whether you're in uniform or not, we all are connected. And we're hoping that Military Family Appreciation Day and the networking from that can go and help the Family Support Network provide better help for the families during the deployment. The problem you've identified after deployment or post-divorce kind of activities is one of those areas that will only happen if people continue pushing on it. And if they continue to recognize that, again, because of technology, the family is involved in the war in ways really they weren't before. This isn't a situation where you might get a letter every 2 weeks. When I was a young lieutenant down in South America, it was a 2-week cycle for me to write a letter to my wife and a letter to come back. Now, because of all the gadgets that are out there, sometimes the guys and gals are expected to be on the phone hearing about what their children did after a firefight, but the family doesn't know about the firefight. But they're still kind of in the here and in the there. And it's a terribly difficult situation.
Following Paul's comment in reference to that, I looked it up while he was talking. Our next reintegration summit is going to be here at the Anderson Readiness Center just down State Street here on May 19th, and it begins at 8 o'clock in the morning. It goes till about 1:30, 2 o'clock, and you're all invited to attend. If you do elect to want to sneak out of here for a little bit, let me know, and we'll make sure that you get an opportunity to address the crowd. And, I mean, it's usually a fairly good crowd. We usually have close to 100 people show up or more to discuss these very issues, and I think it would be a great opportunity for you all to show your support, if nothing else, and we'd certainly accommodate your schedule the best we can to make sure you could get in and talk to this group.
Thank you very much for that offer, General Caldwell. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, General, thank you, Mr. Chair. General, March. I just wanted to appreciate the fact that you're going to celebrate my birthday.
March 19th. I'm
sorry. Oh, March 19th. I've been there in May on my birthday looking for people.
March
19th.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I know we're going to be winding this up, but I just wanted to follow Representative Holvey's lead and offer my services, Paul, if there's anything I can do to help facilitate and sort of juice up the conversations with the colleges over this. I'd be happy to.
Yep.
Yes, sir.
I really think that we need to kind of solve that problem. I think that's a fairly easy problem to solve. I just think we haven't put the right people in the right place to, you know, get everybody's head around it. And I think once we do, it'll probably just be almost a no-brainer. But it's, you know, we've been kind of dealing with it at each's instead of looking at it from a whole. And I think we just need to elevate that and get the right emphasis on it. So in conclusion, I will tell you that there have been several things that have occurred in the legislature over the last several years that have been extremely beneficial to the Oregon National Guard reservists and active duty people who are serving this country. I'll point out one that I think was sort of mentioned a little bit ago about jobs. In 2003, I believe it was, we recognized, and actually it was one guardsman and two reservists were policemen in a central Oregon area, that city police, small town. Total number of policemen, I think, were 9 or 10. 3 of them were deployed. A former state policeman, a friend of mine, called me up and said, you ought to do something about this because I know this chief, and I've helped him out, but I'm retired, and I can only go 6 months, and then I've got to leave. And what we had found, as Paul had indicated, is the people backfill. They've got it, whether they're private or public employers. And he said, if I could just work the whole time, I would have been more than happy to help them out. I'm certified. I've got all the training. And I could have done this. And then when that soldier comes back, I want to go back to retirement. And so it's an easy transition. I said, that's a brilliant idea. So we got together, put a bill up, legislature's in session, zipped through. It's been a real benefit because what we have seen is exactly that. The bill was basically you can serve to backfill any state employee and you or local government, anybody under PERS, and you take no penalties. You get your PERS, and at the end of that tour of duty, you leave and you go right back into retirement. So that made a big difference. In fact, I can't tell you how many sheriffs and local police officers and fire departments that have called and complaining about, my God, I can't lose these two guys. They're both in my fire department. And I said, well, do you know about this PERS thing? Unfortunately, it isn't as well advertised as we would like. We continue to go to the AOC and the LOC and the other organizations and state government and say, remember, this is there. And we do this every time we have a deployment. And every single time there's a new sheriff, new city police chief that didn't know about it. And they'll say, oh, wow, that's wonderful. And they go out and get the retirees. So that's worked well, and that was a nice piece of it. And there's been a multitude of other things that have happened. Obviously, the problem that we've got right now is that, you know, money's tight. It's hard to get even take care of what we got, let alone expand anything. As an example, our relief fund was emptied out in the last biennium. We had $500,000 emergency relief fund. It was gone about 6 months ago. We had some private donations that have come in during that period. We've gone through that. We're down to zero in all categories. Then I get handed an article in the back by one of the audience, and I'd read this earlier in the week, that the Army's sitting on something on the order of $150 million of relief fund money in the Army Relief Fund that they haven't dispensed. And there's a kind of a noteworthy news scandal going on about that. Our people can apply to that. Of course, it's decentralized, it's out of the state, run out of Washington, D.C., so you can imagine the issue. Our program was basically mandated by the legislature and suggested, and we did that. We could turn around a check in less than a day. We cut the bureaucracy out. We made it very, very streamlined. And so if somebody had a problem, we could take care of them that day. If we got it by 8 o'clock in the morning, we'd have the check out by noon. If we got it in the afternoon, we'd have the check out by 5 o'clock. And we were able to do that with that fund. And it helped a lot of soldiers, mainly families. Some soldiers, but mainly families, where we could really make a difference. That money's not there now, so we're working with every private group we can. We're trying to do workarounds. We're trying to do everything we can to help these people. And it just happens. I mean, this is a lot of trauma on these young, and most of these families are young. I mean, they're not, you know, they got little kids. They're struggling to begin with, and then you throw this on top of it, and sometimes it does tip them over, as you've indicated, Representative Huffman, and it's a sad result, but it is a fact of life that we need to deal with. So appreciate the opportunity to come here before you today, and I appreciate your interest in this, particularly in the future of the state, which is absolutely vital that we put these people to work, make them veterans need a help up, they need a hand up, they don't need a hand out. And I think that's what we're talking about, and that's what we appreciate from this committee. So thank you very much.
Well, we certainly appreciate all of your efforts on their behalf, too, Mike. Thank you very much, Vice Chair Huffman.
Thanks, Chair Witt. And, Mike, when you get a chance, off in the hall or something next week, maybe, if we could update on the armory, my armory.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
It's still number one on our list.
Gentlemen, I think I think it's readily discernible here that you have a committee that's eager to assist you in however we might. And as those occasions arise, I want you to feel comfortable to come back to any one of us and let us know how we might be able to be of help and assistance, not only to yourselves, but also to the veterans that are in this state. Thank you so much.
I might just add that I get plenty of opportunity to talk to the community colleges. Since my wife's the deputy director, we have these conversations quite regularly. And so I will again discuss with her today about... which maybe sometimes when I'm driving down the road every 1 hour of the morning, 1 hour of the night, I don't pay as good attention as well as I should have. But I think we can solve some of these issues with this for no other reason because they're a good organization, and I've got an insight. So
excellent.
And thanks for making that connection to me. I didn't realize
that. I may have done her harm. I probably shouldn't have said that.
She's General, she's Major, great. Thank you so very, very much. Certainly appreciate that. I'm going to close the informational meeting on the military, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2732. Just to let everyone know, we're not going to work this bill this morning. We're going to take a very brief testimony. I'm going to have Kevin first give us a rundown. Then I'm going to have our two committee members who put this together as a committee bill tee it up for us. And then we're going to take some short public comment. Kevin.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, this is House Bill 2732. And as the chair indicated, this is the product of Representative Dembro and Representative Esquivel's efforts. We previously discussed this. What it would do is create a task force, the Career and Technical Education Collaboration Task Force. Two primary issues is to identify collaborations and partnerships relating to career and technical education. There is a requirement to submit a report no later than October 1st, 2010, and it does declare an emergency. We have no revenue impact. However, we do not have the fiscal. There is discussion there will be a small fiscal potentially attached to this, but that we do not have at this point.
Thank you very much. Representative Vesquel, would you like to begin the tee up for us, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is actually not my idea or Representative Dimbrell's idea. It's actually, it's our idea, this committee itself. On the testimony that we've received in this committee, we felt that there was maybe a short circuit in the system, and that is from the K-12 system into the community college system into the private sector. So the objective of this bill is to bridge that and to make it easier for a transitional period for an individual that may decide in high school they want to embark upon a career and evolve right into the community college system, which in turn would be an apprenticeship program similar to what Representative Holdy's talking about, being able to become a journeyman eventually. This, I think, is very important to our community itself. I think what we've overemphasized in our K-12 system is the need for college. And yet, it appears that about 82% of all kids that are youngsters that go into high school never graduate out of college. So basically, we're leaving 82% of that population and not doing a whole heck of a lot for them. It also became very apparent that reading comprehension, writing skills, and math skills are something we need to emphasize in the high schools today. Almost word for word, everyone said that was a shortcoming with our workforce. I think the other thing that came out of the hearings was we need to put respect back into the blue-collar worker in our schools. A plumber makes two or three times as much as a teacher. We have to remember that. An electrician makes that same amount. A builder may make five times that amount, maybe even 10 times that amount. These are people that a lot of them don't go to college, but they are exceptionally bright, and more importantly, they have a lot of skills. We should not ever not emphasize the importance of those skills. I think someone summed it up very well here, and I can't remember if it was this committee or another committee I was on that said it's great to have a bunch of engineers graduating out of school, but who builds the bridge? That's the key right there. I'll turn this over to Representative Dimbrell. The only thing I would suggest from the committee is to look at the wording in this, and you'll see that it requests a report from this committee, from this task force. I'm wondering if maybe we should consider having a plan from the task force instead of just a report.
Very good suggestion, Representative Esquivel, and thank you, and thank you to Representative Dimbrell for bringing this this piece of legislation forward. Representative Dimbrell?
Yeah, just very quickly, Representative Esquivel has stated the background very eloquently, I think. And you know, what we saw early on in this committee was that there were a number of good coordination programs happening, but there were also a lot of gaps and a lot of silos. And those, you know, a lot of young people who could really do well, you know, with career education are falling through those gaps. And so we want to close those as much as possible. And, you know, I see this bill really as part of the same conversation that we've been having around issues like House Bill 2398. And, you know, I think that there are probably several bills out there that are related to career education in this way that ultimately could be brought together into something comprehensive and very, very important that can come out of this committee. One of the there is a gap in this bill as it came out of LC, in that one of our goals was to really look at coordination between the K-12 system and community colleges on this issue. And for some reason, what the LC draft has no mention of community colleges, and that's an enormous gap that we'll have to fill through amendment. But that is part of the goal, is to be looking at all these simultaneously, K-12, community colleges, workforce, apprenticeship, employers, I would say veterans, bringing them together.
Thank you very much. And again, thank you to both of you. We're short on time here, folks, so as you come forward, if you could give us the truth, the whole truth, and the really short truth. So, and with that, I'd like to call up Elise Brown and Carolyn Besick, please.
Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
And I understand that there may be other amendments that are needed for this bill as well.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'd say we hope so. Oregon Mentors, first of all, Elise Brown representing Oregon Mentors. Thanks for allowing us to be here this morning. And I wanted to just say quickly that Oregon Mentors is very supportive of House Bill 2732. And in fact, we would respectfully suggest through the amendment process that you create a space for a nonprofit representative to be part of this task force, and we'd love it to be Oregon Mentors. We've heard conversation all morning about high school dropout rates, and they remain very high in Oregon, and certainly understanding that high dropout rates from high school lead to diminishing workforce. So it's Oregon Mentors is currently now with its 100 mentoring programs across the state of Oregon are already working with K-12 and a variety of different partnerships. Carolyn Besick, who's the executive director with Oregon Mentors, can tell you very quickly about a couple of those. Everybody knows about Start Making a Reader Today. We're working with kids at an early age, keeping them engaged in school, and then with partners like Big Brothers Big Sisters, who keeps kids engaged in high school and allows them to realize their potential for going on to two-year, four-year college and even to the workforce. So I'm going to turn it over to Carolyn.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Good morning.
Carolyn Besick, Executive Director, Oregon Mentors. Oregon Mentors' mission is to support those 100 programs throughout the state through things like technical training and technical assistance and volunteer recruitment. Those 100 programs serve approximately 24,000 youth, but there's still a gap. We anticipate about 200,000 kids could use a mentor. So we're continually trying to recruit new mentors to help fill that gap. Many of those programs fit the whole continuum. In other words, there's everything from first grade all the way through age 25. Most of those kids are kids living in poverty in single-parent households. And the reason they're referred to those programs is just that they don't have enough adults in their lives to give them guidance and support. About two-thirds of the programs that we serve do the middle school and the high school age. And what those programs do is they do prevent students from dropping out of high school. There's research that's been conducted that says kids who have a mentor feel more connected to the other adults in their lives, to their parents, their teachers, their guidance counselors, and even their peers. When they feel more connected, they go to school more frequently, their attendance rates go up, and they are more likely to graduate from high school. Mentors' job is to help youth make informed decisions about their future, to set goals and strategies to accomplish those goals, and to understand how to find their next mentor after that formal relationship ends. There are exemplary programs in our state. Aspire is one that goes into the high schools, helps give kids guidance not only how to get to college, but how to prepare for the trades and the community college path. Big Brothers Big Sisters, which of course is operating in Portland, Hood River, Bend, and through a partnership with Committed Partners for Youth in Eugene. Programs in alternative high schools like Open Meadows and POIC in Portland both have mentoring components that help those kids get exposure to careers and learn the skills that we know they need to be successful in careers.
Portland Youth Builders specifically works with kids who've already dropped out, getting their GED, getting the construction trade or the computer trade. And Girls Inc. that does mentoring in a workplace with professional women and girls in a group setting. So those are just some exemplary programs that are being very effective in helping kids get career exposure, know what careers are out there, and also learn the skills that they need to be successful. Thank you very much.
Thank you both very much.
So, Mr. Chair, just in closing, again, we appreciate the fact that this bill would create a very important forum to have those conversations and even create a plan. And, again, we'd love to be part of that. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, first for your advocacy, I guess first for your interest in the bill and also your advocacy and your willingness to serve. That's greatly appreciated. I've heard now two amendments that would possibly be appropriate here. What I would ask is, so that we don't get too many dash amendments, that we have just one, if we could coordinate your request for the nonprofit with Representatives Dembro for the community colleges, if we could coordinate that as one request to LC. The folks down there are buried right now. And we could perhaps coordinate that through Kevin. Mm-hmm. Oh, and I guess maybe a third, Representative Esquivel, the report to...
Well, I'd like some input back from the committee on what they think. I don't think we want a report. I think what we want is a plan.
Okay.
That's my opinion. That's what I thought our objective was, is to have some sort of a plan in place that we could utilize throughout the state of Oregon as kind of a roadmap.
Mm-hmm. Or at least recommendations.
Recommendations. Maybe that's the terminology that we need. Folks okay with that? If we could coordinate, as I say, those three through Kevin so that we get one request going down to LC rather than three separate ones, that would be helpful.
Just one point, Chairman Witt. I've been looking at, and not to get bogged down in minutia, but I just want to make sure I'm clear here. Subpart 11 says the task force shall submit a report and may include recommendations. Would you like that language to be more beefed up, essentially, as I guess what I'm hearing, the shall?
I think de-emphasis on the report and underscore recommendations.
Shall make recommendations.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you so very, very much. Next on the witness sheet is Brian Krieg. Was there anyone else, as Brian's coming up, from the public who wished to testify here today? Okay. Gary, you want to come up? Mike, you want to come up? Okay. I've closed that informational hearing, Mike. I'm sorry. I missed you. Gentlemen, welcome.
Chairman Witt, members of the committee, for the record, Brian Krieg. I'm here today representing the Sheet Metal Workers Local 16, the SMACMA Contractors, and the Plumbing Mechanical Contractors Association. We're very supportive of this. We're very happy to see this is a continuation, really, of the last couple of years of a lot of a good thought, and I think this is the right direction to be going in. The identification, coordination, and the creation of statewide strategies is really essential. Three things within that: development of appropriate programs that really do target and get the kids moving on to actual careers out there. Heading off of duplication of efforts in the state, because I think we have a fair amount of that kind of going on in the scramble over the last couple of years, and some better coordination on that. And then rewarding cooperation between the different organizations that are trying to do the right thing. So if you're partnering up with the right group of people, it's going to go to the head of the class on that. We're really happy to see that there's a labor representative included on the task force, and I really encourage you to be looking at that as someone who would be a training center director or someone who's on one of the boards of those training type centers, so that you really have somebody who is hands-on involved with the training situation out there. So, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Gary?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Gary Conkling, here today representing career colleges. I would like to suggest that the goals of this bill are excellent. I think finding ways to coordinate all of our resources makes sense, but all of our resources do also include for-profit career colleges. They represent choices that students make to pursue certain careers, and I think that they oftentimes are partners with community colleges and others, and it would make sense to include them in your efforts. So while I absolutely agree with Representative Denbro that community colleges should be included, I would encourage you, at the risk of maybe making the table one chair larger, to also include someone from the career college community as well.
Thank you very much. We would certainly be willing to entertain that, and again, if you would coordinate that through Kevin so that we can make one request. Anything?
I have one question.
Yes, please, Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Gary, give me an example of a college like that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, the Culinary Institute, Western Culinary Institute.
Okay.
Many of these schools are they're very targeted. They offer interesting formats. They're degree-granting schools. They either have national or regional accreditation. There is a subsection of career colleges that just provide certificates. I actually represent the career colleges that are the accredited degree-granting institutions.
Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Gary, excellent point. I'm glad you're here today, because oftentimes these are immediate leg up, you know, one-year certification programs that can take somebody from minimum wage to excellent pay very quickly. But often we leave them out of maybe Oregon Opportunity Grants or whatever. A lot of times our funding formulas just miss them, and so it's a very good point.
I appreciate that, too. It would have been a major oversight, I think, to leave out folks like the Portland Art Institute or folks like that. Well taken, Gary.
Thank you very much.
Any further questions? Not seeing any. Thank you both very, very much. Just so that everybody knows where we're going here, the fact that we're going to have some amendments to this bill is going to slow it up considerably. LC is swamped right now. They're dealing with getting bill drafts out, and have made it known that they can't even deal with amendments here for a good number of days just yet. So the intention will be to move this bill out of here. If we don't see it for a period of a week or so, just know it's because we've got a backlog down in LC. Chair certainly appreciates the support from the public on this. With that, I'm going to close the public. Yes.
Before you close, one little comment.
Yes, Representative Holby, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the bill, I noticed that it does direct staffing from an agency, and I'm a little concerned that we potentially undermine the bill with a fiscal. I hope that when this bill comes back, we'll have some time to work it somehow through volunteers or something else, that we can get the fiscal out of this bill so it doesn't die, because I think it's very important it goes forward.
Representative Holby, thank you for bringing that up. And I want to state right now on the record, the chair is upset that this came with a fiscal, and my patience is wearing very thin with state agencies that bring fiscals into these hearing rooms that are unrealistic. I have not done any kind of analysis on this, so I don't have facts to back this up. But my patience is wearing thin. I want to see that fiscal reduced when it comes back before this committee. We will deal with that issue. And Representative Holby, thank you for bringing it up. I'm getting a little tired of this. Yes, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with you 100%. It's kind of like, do we have someone sitting in a closet in the state of Oregon that, when this committee wants to have that person, then they go on the payroll? No. that person's there all the time. So let's get realistic with these fiscals.
And we have a private sector that's voiced this interest in assisting us in these efforts, and if it means that we ask the private sector for a little bit of help here, I'm prepared to do that so that we can reduce the fiscals. With that, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2732. Kevin, brief summary of what we've got coming up.
Very, very brief. Chair Witt, members of the committee, next Tuesday we're set to hear from Future Builders of America. This is John Chandler's organization who was before us. They're going to be bringing some people. Also, we will be doing a work session with respect to HB 2204 concerning the Jobs Plus program.
Thank you very much. Anything else for the good of the order? Not hearing anything, we stand adjourned until next Tuesday. Thanks very much, everyone.